From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And days after Orlando, the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history, gun control is back on the agenda in Congress, although House Speaker Paul Ryan, the Republican, was less than enthusiastic about prospects earlier today.
Is going after the Second Amendment how you stop terrorism? No, that's not how you stop terrorism. We have a bill that's being voted on right now to go after homegrown jihadists. Let's not take our eye off the ball here.
Ryan's comments came just a few hours after Connecticut Democrat and the Senator Chris Murphy ended a nearly 15-hour filibuster with his colleagues, saying Republican leaders in the Senate had promised they would hold votes on amendments to expand gun sale background checks and ban gun sales to people placed on security watch lists. Murphy asked lawmakers to show political courage, and he told the story of 6-year-old Newtown school shooting victim Dylan Hockley. Now, we spoke with his mother yesterday here on this program. Dylan's special needs teacher's aide, Anne Marie Murphy, died trying to protect him when the gunman entered her classroom.
Anne Marie Murphy made the most courageous decision that any of us could imagine. Instead of running, instead of hiding, instead of panicking, Anne Marie Murphy found Dylan Hockley and embraced him.
Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy during his filibuster last night. Susan Davis covers Congress for NPR. So, Susan, where are we? What has happened? Are there going to be votes?
Hey, Robin. Yes, there are going to be votes. What we know is what that 15-hour filibuster accomplished is a deal was struck between Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the Minority Leader Harry Reid to have up to 4 votes. Probably in the early part of next week, it will allow Democrats to have 2 votes and Republicans to have 2 votes. And the 2 votes that Democrats are pushing for, as you referenced, are one to prevent people that are on government watch lists from buying weapons, and 2 for a Democratic amendment that would expand background checks on things like gun shows and internet sales.
Yeah. So, and the government watch list, the point the Democrats continue to make is that if you're on that watch list, you can fly, but not you can't fly, but can buy a gun. And the watch list gap is called the terror gap. So what are some of the bills that are being proposed?
So, you know, on the no fly, no buy, as it's commonly referred to, there are a competing proposal. The Democratic proposal is authored by Dianne Feinstein. She's a Democrat from California, and it has the backing of the Justice Department. And it would essentially block anyone on these lists from purchasing guns, and it would give the Justice Department the ability to decide who would or would not be able to buy that, to buy a weapon. The competing Republican proposal is by John Cornyn. He's the number 2 Republican. He's from Texas. And what his bill would do would instead put a 72-hour requirement on the government to say if somebody flags in that system, it would put the burden on the Justice Department to say that there is probable cause for that person not to be able to buy a gun and to stop the purchase from happening. Mm-hmm. Now, Cornyn's proposal has the backing of the National Rifle Association, the most powerful gun lobby in the country. But opponents of that legislation, Democrats in the White House and others, say that if the government already had probable cause, they would be arresting the suspect as it is and putting that finite a time period to be able to block the sale makes it essentially useless.
Yeah. Look, there have been new polling. There's been new polling showing that there is growing support for a nationwide assault weapons or military-style rifle ban, 57% in favor compared to 44% in December, and that's up from previous polls. Are lawmakers feeling a shift and feeling pressure?
You know, no. And the issue is this, is that guns is probably the most partisan, one of the most partisan issues that have come before Congress in recent years. And the line is really bright. Almost every Democrat is for tighter gun laws, and almost every Republican is against them. And we have seen a handful of lawmakers cross party lines, but we have not seen a fundamental shift in the basic battle lines on this debate in Congress.
So, well, Susan, I just want to jump in, though, and say in the few seconds we have, Donald Trump kind of made some noise about, well, maybe I could think of some restrictions. How that's kind of thrown alarm into some Republican corners.
He did. He tweeted that he was going to talk to the NRA about the no-fly, no-buy. But, of course, the NRA has endorsed that proposal, just the Republican version of that proposal. So we'll see what Donald Trump says. Hillary Clinton has also come out in favor of the Democratic proposals, and she's also come out in favor of an assault weapons ban that was once law but expired several years ago.
Okay. We are living in an interesting time. Susan Davis covers Congress for NPR. We'll see what comes of this. Susan, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, all this week we've been talking about science and featuring different scientists on the cutting edge of their respective fields here in the United States. Today, astrophysics. Ellen Stofan is the chief scientist of NASA, and she is with us now. And Ellen Stofan, give us a sense of a few of the most exciting scientific frontiers at NASA right now.
Well, you know, at NASA, obviously, we study everything from our changing planet to the behavior of our sun to the mysteries of the universe to what's going on all the planets of the solar system. But if you want a theme that really unifies all those, it's really this fundamental question that we have of, are we alone? Is there life beyond Earth? So from in astrophysics, our search for planets around other stars, to our studies of Mars, looking at the moons of the outer solar system like Europa and Enceladus, it's really all about, can we figure out if there's life beyond Earth?
And do you think that we are going to find the answer to that by landing on a planet or by looking out into space at other planets and we'll be able to see from a distance?
The answer to that is yes. So it's actually both of those. So it depends on the problem. You know, when we're talking about extrasolar planets, it's really hard for us to get around the how far away these planets around other stars are. So with our James Webb Space Telescope, for example, that'll launch in 2018, we're going to start studying the atmospheres of these planets around other stars, looking for gases like oxygen, methane, carbon dioxide that would be consistent with a planet being inhabited. Now, that's certainly not proof of it, but at least it gets you to the point where you can see, say, here are some potentially habitable planets around other stars. But frankly, we're still about, you know, at least 20, 30 years away from having the technology to image planets around other stars. When it comes to our own solar systems, when we think about Mars, we're really looking for fossil evidence of life, and unfortunately not very large life, but fossil microbes. So I certainly have a bias, and it's certainly not NASA's plan right now, that we're going to need actually humans on the surface of Mars, not just any humans, but astrobiologists, geologists, cracking open a lot of rocks and looking for evidence of past life on Mars. When it comes to Europa, ultimately, we're going to have to land on the surface and make some measurements trying to seek signs of life. So it depends on your technique, depends on what your target is.
What is the biggest obstacle today in the kinds of things that you're studying? What do we not know that you really need to figure out first to get to the next level?
There's so much that we don't know. When I go out and talk to school kids, I like to tell them, oh, my gosh, you know, everything is out in front of you from us, you know, figuring out a propulsion system that'll get us faster out to those planets around other stars to really trying to understand what are the over 2,000 planets we've now discovered from Kepler. What are those planets going to tell us about how planetary systems form? How common really are habitable planets? How easy is it to get complex life like us? Because life formed so quickly here on Earth, we think that life might be common even in our solar system, in the universe. But complex life, things like us, that took a really long time on Earth. Is that the situation elsewhere? We really don't know. We're really on this verge of being able to understand at least the basic question of where else could life have evolved in our solar system?
I'm sure that you in your daily life run into people who are amazed by what you do and think it's fantastic and think that it should be funded as much as possible. There are also other people in this country who don't see the same value in sending people into space or sending probes deep out into the universe. What is the case that you make to those people about why it matters to us as Americans that you're doing the work that you're doing?
You know, if the fact that we're trying to answer this fundamental question of are we alone, if the fact that with our earth science data we're doing things like helping farmers get higher crop yields and use less water, if the fact that we publish a book every year that's about an inch thick on spinoffs of NASA technologies that don't go into the aerospace industry. They go into industries that help save lives, help companies save money, help small businesses start all over this country. It's actually estimated for about every dollar spent at NASA, about $4 is return to the U.S. economy so that when you invest in space, you're actually investing in your country. If that all doesn't get them, I like to talk about the inspiration. You know, I really do think it's a fundamental part of human nature to explore. But more importantly, when you want kids to go into fields that help build your economy, like science, technology, engineering, math, computer science, you know, if you want kids to go into those fields with technology, space is something that inspires them to follow those careers.
What inspired you? Why'd you get into this line of work?
I'm a hard person to ask that question to because I'm actually a NASA brat. My father worked for NASA. I went to my first launch when I was four. It didn't affect my sister. She's a lawyer. But to me, exploration science was something I was always fascinated in, and the ability to be part of this nation's space program to move humans out beyond Earth was always my dream. And luckily, I get to do it every day.
That's Dr. Ellen Stofan, chief scientist of NASA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, this week for the Here and Now DJ sessions, we are turning our attention to Orlando. And joining us now is Larry Cowden, a.k.a. DJ Brianna, the head DJ at the Parliament House. That's the oldest gay nightclub and resort in Orlando. Larry Cowden, thank you so much for joining us, and especially under these circumstances. We're so sorry for all the things that you've had to go through in the last several days.
Thank you.
Well, and before we get to some of the music that you've been playing, tell us what it's been like for you.
It's really hard to talk about, but I lost a lot of – these were some of my kids. I call them my kids because they were my regulars on my dance floor at the club. We're very close with everybody over at Pulse, such as Barbara, the owner, Axel, Roxy, a bunch of the entertainers from Pulse. We're all family here. And seeing everything that happened, it's been a big emotional drain on all of us.
When did you first hear that something had happened there?
My phone started blowing up about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning Sunday.
Several hours after the attack had started.
Yeah. I had my phone turned down a little bit, and it actually woke me up with the continuing noises from the phone.
And then, of course, you heard what did happen. And the next night, the very next night, a lot of people turned out to the Parliament House.
A lot of us came together. We decided to go ahead and have a vigil with our entertainment director, Darcel Stevens, and the owners, Don and Susan. Many came out to show support and love for each other, trying to hold strong. The man behind Darcel did an amazing speech. There was many press there, many friends, many new faces, many old faces. And as Darcel had said, if Parliament House goes dark, Orlando goes dark. We need not to close the doors. We need to leave these doors open for our family.
Well, let's get to some of the music that you have been playing or are planning to play for your family there in Orlando, the broader family. And this is the first one. This is Inaya Day, You Are My Family, the Toy Armada DJ Grind mix. Here it is.
Listen, I'm reaching out.
Just takes on a whole new meaning listening to it this way.
Yep. Anaya is actually a really good friend of mine. She's a really good friend to the community. And I mentioned this to her yesterday before coming, you know, up here today. And she's very touched by this, very touched that I chose this song.
What does it feel like to play music like that right now for you? Does it make you feel better to listen to it?
It makes me feel like I'm able to show strength and keep all of us together because we are family. They are my family.
Do people dance when you put that on right now?
Well, I'll be honest with you. This past Sunday night after the service, many people went home. I know many people are scared to come out because of everything that had happened. And Every song that I played Sunday night was nothing but positive energy, including Anaya.
Well, let's hear another one that you brought us today. This is Andra Day. This is Rise Up, the Barry Harris mix. Why'd you pick this song?
I'm very good friends with producer Barry Harris, formerly of Thunderpuss. This song has many, many meanings behind this. And I did see that Sunday during Andra's performance, she dedicated her performance and this song to all of us here in Orlando. The meaning, rise up. We have to rise up after this. We cannot let terrorism take us down. We cannot let these people bring us down. We have got to rise up.
What, when you say there are many meanings behind it, what are some of the other ones?
Discrimination, whether it be race, sexual orientation, creed, anything. There's many discriminating reasons behind it. You can see her first meaning of this, and as she stated on Sunday, gives a new meaning to rise up with everything that happened here in Orlando.
Another one of the songs that you brought us is one that many people already know and has in fact already been associated with gay people in the past. This is Lady Gaga, Born This Way. Even before the attack in Orlando, this was kind of an anthem for the gay community.
Exactly. And the reason I chose Lady Gaga on this one, because most of them that were affected that were at Pulse Nightclub, most of them were younger generation. Most of the average ages were anywhere from 18 to 30. If this had happened a long time ago, I would have probably chosen Madonna's Express Yourself, which these two songs have been compared a lot in many ways. I needed to choose something that was very familiar to the LGBT community.
Do you think that there is a big difference between those younger people who are coming in now and people who may have come in 20 years ago in terms of how they view that space, a gay club, how they view the sort of safety of that space for them?
They go in there, they feel secure nowadays. In the past, it took a long time for us to build up the strength and security. I do feel that all nightclubs, every nightclub, I don't care what properties it's on, it could be on a theme park property, everybody needs to enhance security in nightclubs. It's unfortunate. But back on the younger kids today, they feel secure because some of us that are in the older generation made them feel secure.
And now, of course, there's a new level of insecurity because of what just happened.
Exactly. They need visual assurance that they're going to be safe going into any nightclub now. They need to physically see that they're going to be safe.
There is one last song that you wanted us to hear. This is Heather Small with Proud. What have you done today?
What have you done today to make you feel proud?
I imagine that for the first time today, a lot of people listening to this kind of music are in tears or very emotional because of the new meaning that it has taken on for them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I chose Proud because I'm a proud gay man in this community, and I'm going to do my best and try and help people hold it together. I'm trying to hold myself together right now.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, they said a man's best friend is duct tape, and I probably have about 20 rolls laying around ready to be used.
Well, your club is going to be hosting a benefit concert later this month for the families of the victims and the survivors of the attack. What are you hoping to do there, and what do you think they need most right now?
Well, all of us at the Parliament House are coming together to try and get some of the biggest and best entertainment to come in to help raise money for the families and victims of Pulse. We're hoping that we can keep the community together and keep them strong. We're going to do our best.
Well, Larry Cowden, a.k.a. DJ Brianna, at the Parliament House in Orlando, thank you so much for what you've brought us today and what you're doing for the families, and we really appreciate it and hope that you've got what you need to get through this very difficult time.
Like I said, that duct tape is sitting in my car. It's waiting. It's waiting for me.
Yeah, so do it today. Yeah, cause I can see you.
The debate over whether Britain should leave the European Union in the so-called Brexit vote next Thursday became deadly today. A member of Parliament, Jo Cox, was shot and killed. She was in favor of staying in the EU. A man reportedly yelled, "Britain first," before attacking her. The campaigns for and against Brexit were suspended. Someone with the Twitter handle StrongerIn, obviously in favor of staying in, tweeted, "Our thoughts are with Jo Cox and her family." Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Maggie, what a terrible turn. I mean, had the debate heated up this week? What's going on?
It did, Robin. And this is simply shocking. And I think we agree with that statement. We all have heavy hearts today. And I think we're all thinking about her family and her loved ones. The debate has gotten more heated. It's gotten more passionate in part because the polls are so close. Right now, in fact, according to the latest YouGov poll that we were quoting today, the Leave camp has pulled ahead, 46% wanting to leave, 39% remain, 11% undecided. But, you know, the polls, I have to caution, have proved very unpredictable in the past, especially in the UK, and I think many consider it really too close to call at this point.
Well, and so obviously we have this human element now. We're going to hear how this affects the debate going on. I'm sure people in Britain are appalled at this turn. But how has this swing from the Remain In campaign holding the edge to now the Get Out people pulling ahead in the polls, how is this impacting markets?
Investors are getting very nervous about this. We saw Janet Yellen, the Fed chairwoman, mention it as one of the factors that contributed to the Fed's decision not to raise interest rates. And for a long time, I think investors just assumed it was noise. It was going to be a Remain victory despite the campaigning. But as these polls have tightened, they really seem to have woken up to the possibility, wait a minute, this may actually happen. And I have to tell you, anecdotally, I've been getting a lot of phone calls from people in financial markets asking, is this real? And I was in Washington, and no matter what the subject was, we were there for a women's summit. The first thing people were asking me is Britain really going to leave the EU? Mm-hmm. So it is really front of mind for people and very unnerving for the markets right now.
Well, and again, the fact that somebody who reportedly shouted out something in favor of leaving the EU killed somebody today, or allegedly killed somebody today. You have to wonder how that's going to affect that side's cause. But meanwhile, there's research from the services firm Deloitte showing that 49% of businesses are considering the implications of a Brexit, of a leave. So what are they doing?
You know, it's interesting. I just interviewed a BMW board member today, Ian Robertson, and I asked him, and he said nothing changes overnight. Businesses will continue. They most certainly, and many, want the UK to stay in, but they don't believe it will have an immediate and material impact. So they are very much trying to take the long view. That's what I've heard over and over again from CEOs. But I have to tell you, Robin, you've got to believe behind closed doors, they are working on contingency plans simply because we can't handicap what the market fallout will be if they vote to leave.
Yeah. Any thoughts you want to leave us with, Maggie? We got about 30 seconds here. I mean, what else should we be looking for in the coming days?
I mean, I think right now this has created so much uncertainty about the tenor of the debate. I would watch the polls very closely. They're apt to change. This may be what we look back on as a seminal event in this debate.
And a very, very sad one. Again, a member of parliament in Britain shot dead reportedly because of her stand on Britain staying in the EU. Maggie Lake, host CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
The U.S. Senate has agreed to vote on two gun control measures, one that could ban people on the terrorist watch list from getting gun licenses, and a second that would expand background checks to both apply to gun show and internet gun sales. That comes after a 15-hour filibuster by Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who, as a congressman, represented the district affected by the Newtown shooting. But some are saying it's time to go much further and follow the lead of Australia, which adopted much more dramatic gun control measures after a major shooting incident. The Port Arthur massacre killed 35 people back in 1996. And advocates say it worked. There hasn't been a mass shooting like Port Arthur in Australia since then. I spoke with the former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, Tim Fisher, 2 years ago about the gun laws there. And I asked him to describe the day of that attack 20 years ago.
The Sunday afternoon, it was a tourist picnic area and cafeteria and museum. And suddenly this young person picked up a weapon with multi-firing capability and slaughtered some 35 people. And it was the catalyst for John Howard, our Prime Minister at the time, and I was his Deputy Prime Minister, to take it to the state governments that we now needed to harmonise gun laws, to step away from the pathway advocated by the NRA of laissez-faire and to have a sensible set of gun controls without taking away the right for people to have recreational shooting, sporting shooting, along with farmers and ranchers having their requirements as well. And we've turned a corner. There has not been one gun massacre in Australia since 1996. That does not mean that there may not be in the future, but it will come after a couple of thousand people's lives have been saved. Various people estimate around 200 lives a year annually as a direct consequence of the firearms legislation here in Australia.
Well, tell us exactly what you did, and let's start with the semi-automatic restrictions. What are they exactly?
It essentially took out the certain size shotguns. It took out semi-automatics and automatics from being legally available to people. Sporting rifles and other 22s and even more bolt action type were permissible on farm, were permissible in sporting shooters and recreational shooting clubs and hunting and the like. And there is no numerical restriction on the number of rifles. But on top of that, you were required to have a shooter's license issued by each state government after you've done a preliminary test. And that's obviously held against a harmonised set of registers across Australia. And that, I understand, is what is feared most in some ways, is having both a shooter's license scheme and a weapons registration scheme, the two big asks here in Australia. They were legislated for within the 12 months following the massacre at Port Arthur, adopted along with a gun buyback scheme, and the result is plain to see and cannot be denied by the NRA.
Well, and tell us about that gun buyback, because we've had gun buybacks in the United States, but this was a mandatory national gun buyback.
Involving about $500 million, involving a added levy. It greatly reduced accidental deaths by guns, and homicide deaths and suicide deaths.
But there must have been people in Australia who did not sell back their guns, people that maybe shouldn't have even had their guns in the first place, whether they be criminals or whatever.
no legislation can be adopted without someone breaking the law, and some have been apprehended in breaking the law. But it made a difference in two ways. It essentially, it did take out the semi-automatics, the oversized, overpowered weapons from the suburbs of Australia. It also caused people to think, well, do I really need a gun? If I do, I'll apply and get it. But if I don't really need it, I won't go down that pathway. And so we really did walk away from a policy of more and more guns. And we did so perhaps recalling some of the comments that many have made, including Wendy Whitmire from the gun control group Mums Demand Action in the USA. If more guns made us safer, the US would be the safest nation in the world. You are not. You are 10 to 15 times more likely to be shot dead in the USA per capita than Australia. And by the way, you are even safer in Italy than the USA with regard to guns when looked at like for like on a per capita basis.
We're speaking with Tim Fischer, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. Tim Fischer, one of the things you did was add a 28-day waiting period for people who wanted to buy guns. Tell us about that.
It was a cooling-off period. It was the complete opposite of having no background checks at gun shows. And if the US was to do anything, surely it should reinstate that and stand up to the NRA, which risks being completely put offside with its own supporters and the community at large the next time a massive massacre, gun massacre, occurs. You've got to face down such bad anomalies as there being no background check whatsoever for anyone who wants to rock up to a gun show. It just builds and builds the number of guns around, and it has led indeed to people carrying guns still being killed in shootouts.
But I can hear a gun control advocate listening to this and saying, well, it's easier said than done. In this country, there's such opposition to that. There's a strong feeling by gun owners and even non-gun owners that people should have a right to bear arms in this country, and that anything that infringes on that is against the Constitution. How did you manage to overcome that hurdle in Australia to the extent that the same feelings exist there?
Jeremy, that's a good question, and we took the debate to the public square. We stood up at meeting after meeting, John Howard, Prime Minister, myself as Deputy Prime Minister and leader of a party with particular membership from country areas and members and senators from country areas, including many from Queensland, went to meeting after meeting, and that's the only way you'll turn the tide. That and, sadly, a massacre that goes beyond the pale, a massacre that hits up towards 100 dead. No intelligent person can justify allowing no check whatsoever for people to buy guns in the 21st century.
But were you worried for your own political future by getting up and standing up in those town meetings and saying what you did?
Yes, it was tough, and we had a swing against the government at the subsequent elections for a couple of reasons, of which guns was probably not one of those reasons, all things considered. But yes, I was bitterly attacked. I was directly attacked. I was hung in effigy. But some said, look, you're a Vietnam veteran, Tim Fischer. You're a rancher or farmer background. You, above all, should be defending our rights to unrestricted size of weapons, number of weapons, and a laissez-faire approach on guns. I am a Vietnam veteran. I weighed the pros and cons and supported John Howard and the harmonised legislation because I could see this was Australia's chance to jump through the hoops, take some pain, withdraw private property from individuals, but pay them just compensation. The result is there for everyone to see. On any calculation, at least 10 times, and on some calculations, up to 15 times safer than the streets of the USA and places like Duncan, Oklahoma, where a young Australian jogging along peacefully was cut down and slaughtered by guns in the USA not so long ago.
And we should remind people, by the way, that you are a gun owner even to this day.
Yes, I am, happily, and use a gun on the farm and not so much for recreational reasons, but for essential reasons, with livestock needing to be put down and rabbit and fox control. And so be it. I am a happy owner of guns, a rancher down under, a Vietnam veteran, but one that fully supports the harmonised laws that have made a huge difference here in Australia, made Australia so much safer than the USA, who's still has this incredible circumstance where you can have no background checks applied to a person buying a gun, almost any kind of gun, at a gun show in the USA.
Tim Fisher is a former member of the Australian Parliament, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, speaking to us via Skype from his ranch in Australia. Tim Fisher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you indeed.
The attack in Orlando was felt around the world. There were tributes and vigils for the victims and the LGBT community in Paris, Tel Aviv, Sydney, Greece, Chile. This is in London. And in New York, for the first time in its history, the UN Security Council, which normally considers acts of war, weighed in on gay rights, issuing a statement condemning the attack for targeting persons as a result of their sexual orientation. And some of the countries that signed on, Egypt, Russia, are far from gay-friendly. Jessica Stern is executive director of the activist group Outright Action International. Jessica, we understand shortly after the massacre, your organization was pushing the UN for this.
Yes, thank you very much, Robin. And part of the context for our insistence that UN authorities speak out in response to the Orlando massacre comes from 25 years of gradual progress throughout the UN system, where different authorities, be it the treaty body or committees of the General Assembly or even the Secretary General himself, have actually recognized sexual orientation and gender identity as categories of discrimination that cannot be tolerated within a universal human rights framework. And so, of course, after the massacre, we turned to the governments and UN agencies to call upon them to again exercise their leadership, condemn the horrific attack, and provide a human rights-focused way forward.
What was your reaction when the statement actually came out from this particular UN body, the Security Council, which is supposed to wage war or try to, you know, fight for peace? What was your reaction?
Our reaction really falls into a couple of key categories. First point, great step forward. You know, we want to set a precedent where the UN Security Council recognizes that LGBTI communities are affected by acts of gross violence and that we want LGBTI people to be recognized within the context of humanitarian crises and war. The second point is that it really represented progress. I mean, even governments, as you say, like Russia, Egypt, can't overlook massacres motivated by people's sexual orientation and gender identity. Mm. I think the third point I would say is we think it's a real missed opportunity that the statement excluded gender identity. My guess is that there was a lot of negotiating to make this statement happen, and they had to give up something, and unfortunately they gave up the transgender community.
So the transgender community was not included, but as you say, still quite a milestone. And yet, I mean, do you buy it, maybe is the phrase, because, you know, Russia has laws against what it calls propaganda on non-traditional sexual relationships. You know, this is, you know, people in Russia say that they're harassed all the time. You know, signing on to this, we understand there was a lot of arm twisting. You were a part of this process. Might somebody just be going along to look good?
I don't think so. This was a contentious fight, and it comes out of not only 25 years of incremental progress at the UN, but it also comes out of a precedent-setting informal dialogue of members of the Security Council. Mm. The members of the Security Council actually examined the impact of ISIS on people accused of homosexuality and people perceived as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender in Iraq and Syria. So we've been working towards this in a sense. And what does it mean? That's really the billion-dollar question. But I certainly want to believe that every statement starts to push the needle and shift the dialogue further towards human rights.
The New York Times reports that according to the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association, there are several countries in which the death penalty can still be applied for being any of those categories. And homosexuality is still a crime in 73 of the world's 193 countries. What are you hearing from people around the world? Are they stunned at this? Do they think it will carry any weight? Do they think it will make changes where they are? I mean, the UN is sitting in New York.
I think that's a great question. And, you know, we had a staff meeting at Outright, and we were talking about the responses in the countries our own colleagues come from. And, it varies enormously. In the Dominican Republic, there was a right-wing march condemning homosexuality, condemning access to abortion. On the other hand, we talked to colleagues in South Africa who said, there's been a steady stream of community vigils from Cape Town to Johannesburg to Port Elizabeth and beyond. I think the number one question we all have to remember to focus on in this context is, will there be backlash against LGBTI Iraqis and Syrians living in ISIS-controlled areas? And I would say it outright, that's our preoccupation, because now, while we're grappling with a new context of instability and fear, we live with the rule of law. And, it's really the LGBTI Iraqis and Syrians living in ISIS-controlled areas that I think we need to keep in our thoughts and our prayers.
That's Jessica Stern, Executive Director of Outright Action International, the activist group. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. It was really a pleasure to speak with you.
So interesting. Keep in mind, will this mean a backlash against the LGBT community in other countries? We will keep an eye on that. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.